I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo. A favorite South Florida pastime is trashing public transit. But the commuter train service Tri-Rail, which runs through Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach counties, actually gets a thumbs up in this community. It's setting ridership records these days, and that means fewer cars on that eight-lane parking lot known as I-95. So you'd think Florida would consider Tri-Rail a worthy investment. Think again. This year, the state legislature took away two-thirds of the $42 million it was supposed to give Tri-Rail. That's left the South Florida Regional Transit Authority scrambling to fill a $30 million hole in Tri-Rail's operating budget. The authority could sue Florida for a breach of legal contract, but in the meantime, it's looking to the three counties it serves for a rescue. But that's looking like a dim prospect, given that Miami-Dade is suddenly facing a budget crisis and Broward is facing a state DOJ audit. Tri-Rail has enough cash on hand for two more years, but what then? Who can keep Tri-Rail from getting derailed? Joining me now to hash that out is WLRN's Broward County reporter Carlton Gillespie, who's been following this crisis. And we are hoping to have with us Miami-Dade County District 7... I'm sorry? She is not able to join us, unfortunately. We were hoping to have Miami-Dade County District 7 Commissioner Raquel Regalado, who is also a South Florida Regional Transit Authority board member, but she is unable to join us because she is in a very important meeting at this moment. But anyway, Carlton, thanks for coming on. How are you?
Thanks for having me, Tim.
Do you ride Tri-Rail? Let us know what you think. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, Carlton, okay, I want to start here with the core issue, which is the Florida legislature's decision to slash the state's Tri-Rail funding this year from $42 million to $15 million. What was their rationality for a cut that deep, especially when the assumption was that Tri-Rail was supposed to receive at least $42 million, if not more, according to already established state law? I mean, is this an anti-public transit thing up in Tallahassee?
This may be something that's more careless than malicious. Uh-huh. During the state budget negotiations this year, they actually zeroed out the Florida documentary stamp tax and the business rental tax. Both of those taxes were zeroed out in the budget. That money was what Tri-Rail was getting funded with. So by cutting out these two taxes, they've inadvertently zeroed out the money that they could give to Tri-Rail. So there are people at SFRTA, at the Regional Transportation Authority, who think that they can resolve this maybe next legislative session by seeing kind of where the money goes. However, this is an administration that has, as you mentioned, has been very anti-public transit in the past.
Right.
But yes, according to the understanding of the South Florida Regional Transportation Authority, the state is supposed to give them $42 million each year.
Each year. If not more.
The state has interpreted that actually they only need to give them that $42 million, a one-time deal, and now they've given them $15 million. So there's a disagreement on what the contract actually says.
Okay, so there's some litigation policy possibility there. Do Tri-Rail and the South Florida Regional Transit Authority, or SFRTA, do they then have legitimate grounds to maybe sue the state for that missing $30 million?
So when I was listening into a budget workshop last month, the legal counsel for SFRTA brought it up as a possibility, but it was quickly shot down by the executive director because we're on a time crunch here. If they're going to run out of money in 2 years, a lawsuit will take probably much longer than any sort of negotiation they could come to and maybe get some of that money back.
Yeah, it sounds like it could get pretty Dickensian, yeah. So either way, how would you describe the situation moving ahead for Tri-Rail? Because the tone around the discussion of this Tri-Rail funding cut seems to sound a lot more dire now than it did earlier this year when it was first announced.
Right. So when it was first announced earlier this year that there would be a funding shortfall, everyone thought they could reach hands together and fund this thing. But now with the state zeroing out those dollars and changing SFRTA from an agency that's funded by the state to a line item in the budget, it's become much less certain, and you can certainly feel that. It's also important to say that the reason we are having this discussion now is because the can has been kicked down the road on this for over a decade. You know, the state has wanted to get out of this kind of funding for a long time. If you think about how the state funds projects, they fund capital improvements, things like bridges or roadways or drainage systems, not the operation of a train system, which is what they're funding here.
Yeah, that's okay. That's
SunRail in Orlando went through kind of a similar thing, but then COVID-19 dollars came into the picture and a bunch of federal money was paying for Tri-Rail. So nobody had to go into their pockets. And now the end has come here a lot quicker than people thought.
Mm. Now, you recently interviewed SFRTA Director David Deck about this Tri-Rail crisis. Tri-Rail has an annual operating budget of $150 million a year, correct? So losing a fifth of that is no small concern. Deck told you that Tri-Rail has enough cash to get it to July of 2027, 2 years from now. But here's what he said when you asked him if Tri-Rail will be operating in August of 2027.
I don't know.
So, I don't know. So, Carlton, what journalist impression did you take away from your conversation with David Deck about the seriousness of this crisis for Tri-Rail?
Well, missing in that audio clip, because it's not great radio for us, was about a 4 or 5 second pregnant pause he took after I asked him if they would be operating in August of 27. And he says he wish he could tell me, but he doesn't know.
Yeah.
It has gotten very bleak very quickly. And it's not just the folks at Tri-Rail. Even the counties have started to kind of back away from a phrase you heard a lot back in March was cautiously optimistic.
Right.
They're cautiously optimistic they can work with Seferta. They're cautiously optimistic they can find a way to get this funded. I have an updated statement from Broward County this week when I asked for a follow-up and said, we all recognize the benefit of commuter rail to the region. They said, we will continue to work with them as a solution is evaluated. So the cautiously optimistic language is gone from everybody's vocabulary here.
And one of the big things you discussed with Deck was the fact that Tri-Rail was feeling confident enough to make big, or at least plan to make, big capital improvements. But that means going and getting more capital, which means convincing the markets you're in solid shape. And that ain't exactly an argument Tri-Rail can make amid this crisis, right?
Right. You know, they had a number of items like new train stock. They were rewrapping all of the trains. The big concerns people have with using Tri-Rail is that the trains are outdated and the stations need a little bit more.
So here's what David Deck told you about that.
Couldn't have happened at a worse time for SFRTA. We were going out for many capital projects that are multi-year capital projects, as well as, you know, our long-anticipated, much-awaited rolling stock procurement. You know, we need to figure out our annual finances and our livelihood here going forward before we can make such a substantial purchase.
So tell me, Carlton, a little bit more about what he's talking about there.
You heard him mention rolling stock. That's new trains. But there's also things like transit-oriented developments where Tri-Rail can leverage some of its real estate assets, the stations, to have a developer come in and build, you know, some sort of development, a multifamily development there where folks can then have access to the Tri-Rail station as an added benefit for the developer.
Uh-huh.
This is all stuff that's going to take more than 2 years. Why he says this couldn't happen at a worse time. It's not as easy as going to the store and buying new trains.
Right, but that's interesting you pointed out because we've been seeing somewhat the same thing here in Miami-Dade County with Metro Rail. You've seen developers, particularly in places like Coral Gables, having developments that are actually, you know, geared toward closer proximity to the Metro Rail stations, things of that nature. Is that what he's talking about?
Exactly. And the big key of all of this is that it could take that $150 million operating budget and make it either closer to cash neutral or even positive. If you can get some of the developer money, if you can do things like they've mentioned, advertising on the trains, updating the stations to have stuff like concessions or coffee shops, these kind of things that can kind of mitigate the high overhead cost of Tri-Rail. Now, those are all put on hold until they figure out how to just stay alive.
But wouldn't that private-public kind of partnership be the kind of thing that you would think a state legislature like Florida's would want to encourage?
Absolutely. But again, this is a discussion that's been had for years now. The state has wanted to get out of funding the operations of this system.
Yeah.
And like I said, the can has been able to be kicked down the road. to we're now at a crisis point that's way, way deeper than, you know, the state deciding not to support these things, because they were for a long time. These initiatives aren't new, but now the funding is a problem for them.
But and again, going back to this one point I made in the introduction here to this segment, ridership is at record levels for Tri-Rail. Again, you would think that would be an encouraging factor for Tallahassee in terms of whether to keep this system alive or not.
They've never been more popular, have Tri-Rail.
As I said, yeah.
The past 2 years, they've set ridership records. But what that means, too, is if you think about the opportunity cost, whatever the impact of funding Tri-Rail would be on a budget, it would certainly be less than the impacts that could happen to state-funded roads like the Turnpike or I-95 yeah. or the Sawgrass Expressway.
Well, we're going to get to that infrastructure question in a bit. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with what we were hoping to speak with Commissioner Rigolato. She was not able to join us, but I am speaking with WLRN's Broward County reporter Carlton Gillespie about the crisis facing a popular South Florida transit service, Tri-Rail. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, okay, Carl, I want to turn now to the question of who can and or should be rescuing Tri-Rail right now from this daunting $30 million shortfall it's facing as a result of the Florida legislature's deep funding cuts. The South Florida Regional Transit Authority, or SFRTA, has indicated it feels the three counties that benefit from Tri-Rail service, Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach, should fill that hole with $10 million each. But as I mentioned at the outset, the counties themselves have big financial issues going on right now. Either way, should the counties be coming to the rescue?
Well, that $10 million is an additional $10 million. Each county already does fund Tri-Rail at a rate of about $4.2 million a year.
Uh-huh.
That is the statutory minimum that the counties are required to pay in.
Mm-hmm.
So the regional transit authorities, the transportation authorities' argument is that if DOT has been paying in, as they have, more than their statutory minimum, then they've been easing the burden on these counties for uh-huh. years and years and years. That's another reason why the state certainly thinks it's time for the counties to start funding this, right? Because
right.
this is something that only helps these counties, this kind of system.
But as you mentioned to me earlier when we talked about this, the $10 million each may not be equitable because, for example, Miami-Dade does not see as much Tri-Rail service come into its county as Broward and Palm Beach do, right?
Yeah, and it's also important to note that that $10 million would be for this year and maybe next. It could go up to high as an additional $30 million per year if DOT gets out of funding Tri-Rail entirely. This would be a massive capital expense. And like you mentioned, in Miami, the Tri-Rail dead ends at the government center and at the airport. So, and I'll say it without laughing, if Coastal Link or something like that could ever happen,
yeah.
maybe there's more of a desire in Miami-Dade to kind of fund these sort of mm-hmm. projects.
Well, and we do now want to welcome onto the show Miami-Dade Commissioner Raquel Rigolato, who is also a board member of the South Florida Regional Transit Authority. Commissioner Rigolato, thanks for joining us.
No, my pleasure. And thank you so much about talking about Tri-Rail and SFRTA.
Okay, well, listen, now you're jumping into the conversation at a perfect point, because I want to ask you, Carlton and I have been talking about whether or not the three counties should be ponying up more, as the transit authority seems to indicate, to fill this $30 million hole. We've also made the point that Miami-Dade really shouldn't be expected to pay perhaps as much because it doesn't have as much Tri-Rail service coming into the county. But I wanted to ask you, Commissioner, doesn't Miami-Dade have a bigger stake in seeing Tri-Rail survive, though, after it made such a big deal of getting Tri-Rail service into Miami Central Station last year?
Yeah.
Like something like more than 25 trains a day, no?
Right. So a few things. I think we did have a meeting. The three counties did have a meeting yesterday where they talked about potential commitments to sustaining SFRTA. So that is happening in real time. When I became the chair of SFRTA, for the first time, we took the meetings to every single county and we created committees where the transit authorities for the county were participating in getting into Miami Central and in conversations about the Coastal Link. So I think our relationships right now in the Tri-County area are much better than they were 4 to 5 years ago. And we've really made an effort to reach out to our county partners. That was not the Tri-Rail of 7 years ago.
Right.
The Tri-Rail 7 years ago existed in a vacuum. In terms of Miami-Dade County's commitment, Miami-Dade has made an enormous commitment to Miami Central. It came out of a lot of different buckets of money, and it's been a huge investment. And we are also investing on extending the express train, which has been very popular. But Miami-Dade County, on the zoning side, we just added the first ever tri-rail station that has been added to this line in over 20 years. It's in Little River at zero cost to SFRTA and at zero cost to Miami-Dade County.
Right.
We met with the developer. Swirlo is paying for this station. And that's one of the models that I've taken to FDOT as we explain the future of SFRTA.
Right.
You know, do we partner? Do we use zoning? Our zoning, Miami-Dade County zoning, has increased around the tri-rail stations. I added the tri-rail stations to our RTZ, and we've asked our Broward and West Palm partners to do it. We did a transit project in Palm Beach, but the zoning was a nightmare.
Right. Commissioner Regalado, if I could just step in here. Speaking of meetings, the South Florida Regional Transit Authority has a meeting next Friday to confront this tri-rail crisis. If the lost tri-rail funding cannot be made up, what are then the service reductions and possible fare increases you see it having to make in order to keep the trains rolling?
So we actually had a workshop where we discussed all of our different options so that we wouldn't catch folks unaware. We have been meeting with FDOT, and I've requested a five-year plan from FDOT where we would eliminate state funding through this process of a five-year plan, but they would give us these stations, because one of the issues that we have with developing these stations is we are not the owners of all of these stations. They also require us to do these pedestrian bridges. They don't allow us to do on grade. I've put out a series of RFPs to have vending inside the stations, and nobody wants to do it because nobody wants to deal with FDOT. So we are working on a parallel plan to have a five-year agreement with FDOT, which resolves a lot of their issues.
Okay.
Alternatively, what we will be discussing at Friday is increases to fares. I have also talked about eliminating first and last mile completely and giving that money back to FDOT. If you've been following that, Miami-Dade County does not get first and last mile. I did not do that in Miami-Dade County, but in Broward and West Palm, we do provide a $5 Uber ticket for our riders, and that was one of the first programs that we would put on the table.
Okay.
And then I'm having the executive director look at dynamic pricing. So we would be increasing our pricing specifically for events.
Commissioner Regalado, unfortunately, we've run out of time for this segment, but we do want to end things here with a call from Merrill in Hollywood, who says they're a big fan of Tri-Rail. Merrill, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. Why are you such a big fan of Tri-Rail?
Hi. Well, I moved here from California, where there's a lot of great transportation. And at first in Florida, there wasn't anything. And then Tri-Rail started to expand, and I was able to take it to and from work, avoid the 95, which was full of accidents all the time, and relax.
Right.
And I think a lot more people should have been taking it.
Right.
I was always hoping that it would be expanded to go all over different parts of Florida, you know.
Okay. Well,
so,
Merrill, we hope you can keep riding. Thanks for your call. We will have to end things there. Carlton Gillespie is WLRN's Broward County reporter. Raquel Regalado is a Miami-Dade County Commissioner and a member of the South Florida Regional Transit Authority Board. Many thanks to you both.
Thanks, Tim.
Still to come, is the plague of pill mills returning to Florida? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Back in the 2000s, Florida was a focal point of America's opioid crisis. So at the end of that decade, the state passed laws to regulate so-called pill mills, the clinics that recklessly prescribe addictive pain drugs. And it worked. Between 2009 and 2014, the number of pill mills in Florida dropped almost 60%. The number of opioid-associated deaths fell too. The pill mill scourge seemed to have been contained. But a new federal investigation is raising fears that pill mills could be making a comeback in Florida, including South Florida. It's also raised questions about whether the state's pill mill laws are really the effective oversight we thought. New cases involving doctors, pharmacists, and patient recruiters, ranging from Hallandale Beach to Hialeah, from Davie to Tampa, are raising questions about tools like prescription drug tracking databases that were supposed to keep vigil over this problem. Joining me now in the studio is Jake Shore. He's WLRN's new investigative reporter for Broward and Palm Beach counties, and he's been looking into this new pill mill probe more closely than anyone. Jake, welcome to WLRN. How are you?
I'm good. Happy to be here.
We'd like to hear your thoughts about a possible pill mill resurgence in Florida. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, Jake, as I mentioned there, pill mills are not a particularly new story in Florida, but what made you look into this latest development? What stood out for you?
Yeah, I had just started at WLRN, and I, like any reporter, was looking for a story. I come across a Department of Justice press release, and I'm kind of surprised to see a doctor who was indicted in June for prescribing millions of pills to clients that he had never seen. And he was based in Broward and Miami, Miami-Dade. And, you know, I had heard some of the history about the pill mill crisis and the laws that were passed in response to it. And, you know, I wanted to understand how a doctor, you know, was able to do this without raising any alarm bells in the state for years, you know.
So before we move on, let's back up a little and remind folks how bad the opioid pill mill crisis was a couple decades ago and the legislation that Florida passed 15 years ago to confront it. What were the big tools the state created?
Yeah, and you know, I'm the new Broward and Palm Beach County reporter, so I was looking for stories that, you know, impact those areas. And specifically, sure, this was a huge problem for Palm Beach and
exactly.
Broward counties.
Yeah.
A grand jury report actually found that, you know, at the time in 2008, 2009, every 3 days on average, a new pain clinic opened up in those counties. Mm. And, you know, it was really easy and it was really profitable for doctors to set up shop, you know, on any corner, and somebody to walk in, say the right things, and walk out with a prescription for opioids. And what law enforcement actually found was that South Florida was fueling the opioid epidemic in the late 2000s, early 2010s, mm-hmm. and fueling crime and deaths in, you know, other states.
So how did this new state law combat that?
Yeah, so they actually passed two pieces of legislation, mm-hmm. You know, after a really fraught process. The first law, you know, was really basic. It said, hey, if you're starting a clinic in the state, you got to register with us and you got to submit to a yearly inspection.
Right.
The second one was a prescription drug monitoring database. And what mm-hmm. it meant was, and what in theory it was supposed to do, was that if I went into a clinic and I got a prescription for opioids, that, you know, that would go into a database and doctors are supposed to check that to make sure that I'm not doctor
right.
shopping.
And all this, as I mentioned, it worked to a large extent, right?
Yeah, it worked. It cut the number of clinics down by more than half. And, you know, the problem was kind of largely forgot about. And
but also, how important was this not just to Florida, but to the rest of the country? The
yeah.
fact that we were fixing the problem here, how did that resonate?
Yeah, it was, you know, it was seen as a success story in the state. And, you know, even our current Attorney General, Pam Bondi, who used to be the Attorney General mm-hmm. for Florida, you know, counts it as one of her major achievements, is that, you know, putting a lid on the pill mill crisis, and it stopped mm-hmm. the flow of drugs from these legal means, mm-hmm. You know, to more illegal means.
So fast forward to this new federal investigation you discovered involving two alleged pill mill clinics here in Florida, including South Florida, and millions of pills of the pain med oxycodone. How did this alleged scheme work? And who are the doctors, pharmacists, and other people allegedly involved?
Yeah, so the federal prosecutors charged Dr. Sergey Margulian with doling out these pills illegally to clients he hadn't seen. He was doing it out of like tiny clinics in Davie and Hialeah. Mm-hmm. I actually visited the Davie clinic, and you know, it's next to it is an ice cream shop and a pawn shop, and yeah. you know, I was stunned by the amount of pills that were coming out of it. And you know, when I looked into this case, it's actually tied to two Broward County pharmacies, two licensed pharmacists, one of whom has already pleaded guilty and surrendered her license.
Right.
The rest of the defendants pleaded not guilty.
But there's also a Tampa connection, though, too, right?
Yeah, one of the pharmacists is from Tampa, based mm-hmm. there, but owns the pharmacies in Broward County. You know, what I wanted to learn was how these laws, the ones that were so successful at stopping the crisis, mm-hmm. intersected with this case.
Right.
I thought I would find something in these yearly inspection reports. I thought maybe something got missed. I got the reports from the Department of Health, which is overseeing
yeah.
the clinics, and the inspection report said that, you know, they were passing with flying colors
right.
at the same time as
this behavior. So obviously the larger
yeah.
issue here is, why didn't those new Florida laws we just discussed
mm-hmm.
detect this alleged pill mill activity before it got to the point where, as the Department of Justice investigation alleges, the doctors involved, like Dr. Margulian, were prescribing oxycodone, quote, without regard to medical need?
Yeah. And just to put, you know, another pin on it, you know, clients would come in to the pharmacies with their prescriptions in hand, and they would get prescriptions from multiple other people, getting pill bottles for, you know, regular use oxycodone, and would pay $800 a bottle. Like, these are things that would raise flags in pharmacies,
yeah.
but, you know, it didn't happen. And so this was one of the holes in the state oversight that I identified.
Right.
Was the, you know, the inspections, I had sent them to an experienced drug investigator, and she told me that, you know, basically if you have four walls and a roof and clean equipment, you're good. You know, it's procedural. It's not looking at, mm-hmm. hey, who's prescribing what? And, you know, and this was a law intended to stop pill mills. And
yeah.
and it's a clear kind of loophole.
That was supposedly the kind of laissez-faire that the 2010 law was supposed to,
right.
laws were supposed to confront. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with WLRN's Jake Shore about a possible pill mill resurgence in Florida and questions surrounding the state laws that were supposed to prevent it. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. And a reminder that if you miss any part of the program, you can search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. So, Jake, I want to stay here on this question of why the pill mill laws Florida had in place for some 15 years now did not seem to sniff out this big new alleged pill mill scheme the feds are investigating now. And one of the big concerns is how the doctors and pharmacists and patients involved were able to get around the laws. I want to play a clip here from your interview with former Palm Beach County State Attorney David Ehrenberg, who's co-authored a new book titled Fighting the Florida Shuffle, about corruption inside the drug treatment industry.
There's privacy restrictions. And so it could happen that someone is an excessive user or purchaser of these drugs, and it escapes the notice of law enforcement. But that's the way that the legislature designed the prescription drug monitoring program. They wanted to be somewhat of a passive system. They didn't want bells and whistles to go off when someone reached a certain threshold. So it's up to the doctor or the pharmacist to alert the authorities that something is amiss.
Up to the doctor or the pharmacist. It sounds a bit like Florida's law sort of let the fox in charge of the hen house. No, and I was also struck by Ehrenberg's description of the law as passive. Jake, what should we take from what he said there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, picture any kind of database where you're just putting numbers in and it's not doing anything unless the people looking at them decide to. So he said a doctor or a pharmacist has to alert the authorities. Somebody has to say something. And I asked him, I said, well, what if the people who have to say something are in on it? And he didn't have a good answer. And
yeah.
that's the hole in the oversight right there. And that's what we saw in this case.
So what did the Florida Department of Health say when you brought them your reporting on this new pill mill investigation?
Yeah, I sent them a detailed list of questions. I, you know, wanted to learn about these inspection reports and why they didn't flag this activity that federal prosecutors saw was illegal. They didn't really respond to it. They mainly responded to the prescription drug monitoring database that, you know, former prosecutor Ehrenberg just addressed.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that, you know, it's not set up in a way to flag illegal activity. It doesn't investigate. That's not its purpose. Its purpose is to stop doctor shopping and for responsible doctors to check it to make sure that, you know, they're not giving drugs to somebody who's using the system illegally.
Okay.
And they didn't comment on the other parts of my investigation.
And what about Dr. Margulian and the other defendants? What did they tell you?
Yeah, they Dr. Margulian, I reached him. He declined to comment. The other lawyers for the other defendants either didn't respond or declined to comment. I did talk to the lawyer for one of the pharmacists who pleaded guilty. He said that she owned up to it and she, you know, was a pawn in this scheme and didn't really mm-hmm. benefit from it. So, you know, all this to say that the database and the registration, you know, it leaves some holes that could be filled.
Where do things stand with the investigation now? What are the likely next developments, especially when it comes to what action the medical boards here might take? You report, for example, as you've suggested, that one pharmacist involved has already pleaded guilty and surrendered her license, right? What else could we see from the medical board side of this?
Yeah, she surrendered her license, but again, just like with the system that we laid out, it's very, you know, on the person involved to say something. You know, if I'm a doctor and I'm arrested, I actually am not required to report that to the medical board unless I'm convicted. Even in the, you know, for Dr. Margulian to be bonded out, to be let out of jail, one of the parts of his bond was he told the federal judge, yes, I will surrender my medical license. But if you check the Florida Department of Health license verification, you know, it shows no black marks. Same thing with the other pharmacist. She's not supposed to work in well, pharmacies.
I have to admit, as a layperson, I'm a little confused, if not stunned, that, you know, I would have thought that back in 2010, the law would have expressly, you know, made sure that it wasn't doctors and pharmacists that were responsible for reporting this, precisely because, as you mentioned, they are often a big part of the problem. So in the end, do Ehrenberg or other sources you spoke with recommend that the Florida legislature go back into the state's pill mill laws and perhaps make their monitoring tools like this database more active, let's say, instead of passive, so we don't see a full-blown resurgence of this problem?
Right. When I talked to Ehrenberg, you know, he said he always wanted it to be a more active system. But honestly, it was such a fight to put it in place when they first passed it. It was actually not funded fully until 2 years after. And so he said it was a success despite all of the roadblocks that they faced. He would like to see a more active system. You know, medical boards, they will have to investigate it if somebody ever files a complaint against the doctor, the pharmacist. Mm-hmm. You know, if he does surrender his license, there would be hearings. But, you know, it's largely on the people involved right now, and that's how the system's set up.
Have you heard any rumblings that there could be a move afoot in Tallahassee to take a second look at these laws as a result of this investigation that's going on now?
Not that I've heard yet, but, you know, I will keep looking out to see if there's any more cases that fit this pattern and, you know, see if there's any developments with the doctors and the pharmacists.
Great reporting, Jake. Jake Shore is WLRN's new investigative reporter for Broward and Palm Beach counties. Jake, again, welcome and many thanks.
Thanks.
Still to come, why salsa is making a comeback on our dance floors. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. If you're as old as I am, you remember when salsa music had its big crossover moment in the 1970s, thanks to artists like Ruben Blades and Willie Colon, and legendary Puerto Rican pianist Eddie Palmieri. Palmieri died last week in New Jersey at age 88, and when he left us, he had to be happy about the unmistakable salsa music revival happening today. If you thought reggaeton ruled Latin music, consider that reggaeton superstars like Bad Bunny and J Balvin and Karol G are all embracing salsa this year. And in Latino-majority cities like Miami, Gen Z is hitting the dance floor with the music their parents and grandparents sashayed to back when the queen of salsa, Celia Cruz, was a household name here. Joining me now in the studio to look at this salsa resurgence is Florencia Franceschetti. She's the music editor at the Miami New Times. Flor, great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Are you dancing salsa again? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, Flor, Miami New Times was actually one of the first to see this salsa revival bubbling up. You published a really good article last fall on Puerto Rican American singer Luis Figueroa, who was mentored by salsa star Marc Anthony, and his efforts to so-called reinvent salsa for a new audience. Llorar Bonito, one of the songs from his new album, which means crying pretty, was nominated for a Latin Grammy for Best Tropical Song. Flor, how would you describe the kind of salsa that Luis Figueroa is performing there and why it seems popular with this new salsa audience artists like him are targeting?
Well, that article was originally published by Osvaldo Espino, one of our writers. And something that Miami New Times has is great writers that love their music and
I would
do,
agree. Yeah.
You know, do the research. So I think they are the ones who are really in the ground, like identifying all these movements and being part of them and talking to the artists. And in this song, I think it sounds like a traditional, you know.
And I want to get to that. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Like, and what I love about this resurgence is that reggaeton artists and like younger generations of artists are introducing old school salsa to new audiences. Mm-hmm. Also kind of like in their own way. Right.
And I have to admit, though, Flor, Figueroa's track there sounds, as you just mentioned, like a pretty conventional romantic salsa track. As we said, it's popular, but is it necessarily pushing salsa forward the way, say, the Cuban ensemble Los Bon Bon did a generation ago? So either way, Flor, what's your sense as to why salsa is making this comeback these days? The Miami Herald, for example, had a fun article this week about Gen Z dancing up a salsa boom here. Miami New Times had one out today, right? Why is the reggaeton generation reaching back to salsa?
Well, I think it's a Gen Z thing. Mm-hmm. I think it's a more nostalgic generation. Me as a full-on mm-hmm. millennial,
right?
I think that we didn't do that exercise of searching our roots. We were more like looking at other cultures in a different way, or like maybe looking. I'm a rock and metal girl. Mm-hmm. That's my background, mm-hmm. but I grew up dancing.
You're from Argentina, right?
I'm from Argentina.
So you're probably a fan of Los Fabulosos Cadillacs, right?
Yeah. Okay. So Fabulosos Cadillacs, Los Redondos. Mm-hmm. But I danced salsa for a long time. Mm-hmm. But it was like in the 90s with the second revival.
Right. Which we're going to get to. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. With like Chichi Peralta and all that. Mm-hmm. But going back to your question, I think Gen Z, it's a more curious generation and it's seeking, looking back to the roots. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the reason why mm-hmm. There's a comeback.
No, that's a really interesting point you make about Gen Z being a more nostalgic generation. That's something I really hadn't appreciated before you brought that up early when we were talking. Now, Puerto Rican reggaeton superstar Bad Bunny has, of course, been one of the central figures in this new salsa boom with his new album, Debí Tirar Más Fotos. But I wanted to ask you, from your perspective, is Bad Bunny the salsero as good as Bad Bunny the reggaetonero? I mean, is he making an artistic contribution to the salsa genre here, or is he just embracing it to ride a trend?
Well, I think his contribution, it goes beyond the musical one. I look at it as a cultural one, mm-hmm. because thanks to him, even though, you know, we can debate on execution and of genre execution.
Sure.
Thanks to him, there are many younger generations actually listening to salsa.
Right.
And, for example, in the article that came out today on Miami New Times, written by Monica Mendoza, she interviews Elisa, that she's the girl who started Salsa C. That is this...
Elisa Baena.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That it's these gatherings that she teaches Gen Z how to dance salsa. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And she admits that it was through, after listening to Debí Tirar Más Fotos, the album, Bad Bunny's album, mm-hmm. that she was like, oh, this is the time for me to start Salsa C.
Yeah, no. That's I think that's correct. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with Miami New Times music editor Florencia Franceschetti about the salsa revival that's sweeping Latin music and Miami's dance floors. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Now, Flor, for someone who's been listening to salsa music as long as I have, this is certainly not the first salsa revival we've seen over the years. I mentioned the 1970s crossover moment with the Fania All-Stars and company. But I remember the 1990s when we sort of thought salsa was a musical dinosaur, sort of on the way out. And then all of a sudden, Juan Luis Guerra comes along with Como Abeja al Panal. And suddenly, we're back on the floor dancing salsa again. But my question is, why does salsa continue to prove itself to be Latin music's resilient comeback kid of a genre generation after generation?
Well, I think it's, again, going back to searching our roots, right? And taking things that were so, that identify culture so much, mm-hmm. and then twisting them to have a more contemporary, you know, version of it. So I think it's generations looking at what their grandparents were doing, or you know, looking for those warm moments, because that's what salsa brings, right? Like fun.
It's interesting to say that, because familia is such an important factor in Latin culture, right?
Exactly. And I think this just brings back good memories, especially when, you know, politics are kind of weird.
Yeah, to say the least.
So, yeah, I think that's...
But of course, that raises the question, going back to our earlier discussion of Luis Figueroa, for example, what is each generation bringing to the salsa genre? I mean, on the one hand, we've got reggaeton stars like Rauw Alejandro doing covers of classic salsa tracks like Tu Con Él, or You With Him, which was first recorded 40 years ago. But then we've got contemporary Latin artists like Carol G of Colombia creating salsa remixes of their more hip-hop stuff. What's your verdict? And what do you think Gen Z's verdict is then on how Carol G's remix approach works as salsa? And as I mentioned, she's not the only one. J Balvin, for example, is another reggaeton superstar who's doing remixes of his hip-hop stuff into salsa. What's your verdict?
Well, I think there are two things there. We have, for example, J Balvin and Rauw Alejandro, that sometimes they go back to collaborate. Like now J Balvin just released a song with Gilberto Santa Rosa. And he really brings the old school into the new school, which I think is cool for new generations to listen. Maybe people that never listened to Gilberto now, you know, are listening to him through J Balvin, which some people would say, like, what? But, you know, that happens. Same with Rauw. He did his version of the song of Tu Con Él is almost the same, right? Yeah. So it's a really good tribute to that.
Which is sort of like, you know, Rod Stewart, you know, English singing superstars who do, they go back and they do recordings, nostalgic recordings of the Songbook, for example. Or even when, I'm going out on her name, but when she did an album many years ago of old Cuban songs, for example, we see this a lot, right? Of, you know, going back and just trying to reintroduce a new generation to those old hits. Gloria Estefan.
No, that's fine. But so I think it depends on the approach. I think it's beautiful that new generations are being introduced to so iconic sounds, like, you know, for Latin culture, like salsa. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to judge, but I think it's great that people are listening to more salsa in any form or shape.
But again, I was asking you your verdict on, you know, this fusion, you know, remixing the more hip hop stuff with salsa stuff. Does that work for you as a music critic?
Well, for me, it's not my cup of tea. I'm more of a nostalgic. I like more like the Rauw Alejandro tributes that are sticking to the traditional. But I also like diversity. I like to see, you know, some versions could hit the mark and some might miss it. Mm-hmm. So it depends on the version. But I think it works for Gen Z because it's a new way for them, a new package, you know, to new packaging for an old thing. So it might work for them.
Now, finally, Floor, what's the vibe you're feeling when you see Gen Z and this younger crowd out dancing to salsa around Miami and South Florida these days? As we pointed out, Miami New Times has an article about this out today. And I guess the big question is, have they learned the steps like their abuelo and abuela did, or do they fake it like me?
I think they learn. Mm-hmm. I think they learn. Like, I see happiness. I see people enjoying themselves, people being part of community and finding community. And I think, and not to turn it, you know, political, but I think for Latin people and like second, third generation of Latin people that want to be connected to their roots, this sense of gathering through dancing works a lot and makes people feel happy. So I think.
But you mentioned in the 1990s, I think you said, as an Argentine, you took salsa lessons, you know, in a country where tango was so prominent. Why would an Argentine be wanting to take salsa dancing lessons?
Well, it made me happy. I also like the costumes.
Okay. Florencia Franceschetti is the music critic for Miami New Times. Flor, many thanks. I really enjoyed the discussion. Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Finally on the roundup, speaking of legendary music, last year, the Florida legislature designated August 30th as Jimmy Buffett Day, honoring the celebrated Key West singer-songwriter who died in 2023. And South Florida is getting ready to celebrate Buffett and his musical legacy on that day. Up in Palm Beach County, you can catch Party in Paradise at the amphitheater in Delray Beach. In Broward, where else? At the Margaritaville Hollywood Beach Resort. And of course, in Key West, the Parrothead capital of the world, a cornucopia events from Parrot Fest to the four-day Favorite Son celebration. Get your fins on. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to its podcasts. Today's show was produced by Amy Sanchez with assistance from Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital director. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news, the vice president of radio, and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN.